Hello, and thank you for listening to Mapping the Zone, a podcast that is ordinarily about big, complex books, particularly the works and context of Thomas Ruggles Pynchon. This week, however, just like last week and the next couple of weeks, we are not talking about a Pynchon book. We are filling some space until we get started with our next season with some bonus episodes, as we usually do. And it is my turn to provide, as I guess Cody typified last week, a sales pitch on another piece of media that I enjoy. Instead of going down the same route that I have with the last two books that I've covered, out of, I guess what I'll say, analysis paralysis of staring at my bookshelf going, I don't know who to pick! I decided to go back to the well of my old friend David Foster Wallace, and look at his book The Pale King as my recommendation for this week. And I'm going to start with a quote, just how the book opens, which I think is just like beautiful and perfect. It starts with a quote here that says, "We fill pre-existing forms, and when we fill them, we change them, and are changed," which is by Frank Bidart in Borges and I. And the book starts this way. Past the flannel plains and blacktop graphs and skylines of canted rust, and past the tobacco brown river overhung with weeping trees and coins of sunlight threw them on the water downriver, to the place beyond the windbreak where untilled fields simmer shrilly in the AM heat. Chatter cane, lamb's quarter, cut grass, sawbriar, nutgrass, jimson weed, wild mint, dandelion, foxtail, muscadine, spine cabbage, goldenrod, creeping charlie, butterprint, nightshade, ragweed, wild oat, vetch, butcher grass, invaginate volunteer beans, all heads gently nodding in a morning breeze like a mother's soft hand on your cheek. An arrow of starlings fired from the windbreak's thatch, the glitter of dew that stays where it is and steams all day. A sunflower, four more, one bowed, and horses in the distance standing rigid and still as toys, all nodding. Electric sounds of insects at their business, pale-colored sunshine and pale sky, and whirls of cirrus so high they cast no shadow. Insects all business all the time. Quartz and shirt and schist and chondrite iron scabs and granite, very old land. Look around you, the horizon trembling, shapeless. We are all of us brothers. Some crows come overhead then, three or four, not a murder. On the wings, silent with intent. Corn bound for the pasture's wire beyond which one horse smells at the other's behind. The lead horse's tail obligingly lifted. Your shoes brand and sized in the dew. An alfalfa breeze, socks burrs. Dry scratching inside a culvert, rusted wire and tilted posts, more a symbol of restraint than a fence per se. No hunting! The shush of the interstate off past the windbreak. Pasture's crows standing at angles, turning up patties to get at the worms underneath. The shapes of the worms in size and the overturned dung and baked by the sun all day until hardened there to stay. Tiny, vacant lines and rows and inset curls that do not close because head never quite touches tail. Read these. It's a shame that this book is somewhat, I don't know if I would necessarily go so far as to say forgotten, but ranked lower in David Foster Wallace's canon of written works. Because it has just as much, in my opinion, to offer as basically everything else that the man wrote once he kind of entered his mature period of understanding his own writing. Now, no discussion of this book can really proceed or be understood in context without understanding the fact that it's unfinished. This is the book that David Foster Wallace was writing when he did commit suicide. And was a book that he was apparently writing for years and years and years and years prior to it happening. There is an excellent article by The New Yorker, written by his friend Jonathan Franzen, about the concept of the unfinished in his work, particularly this book, and how his personal life, along with the struggles in writing this book, kind of collided to create a kind of toxic mix that may or may not have contributed to the causes of suicide. I'm sorry, the Unfinished is actually by Max Brooks, his biographer. His friend Jonathan Franzen did write a book where he went to a remote island to read it and talks about the experience reading. And so it's kind of looking at the history of this book. David Foster Wallace, in a lot of letters to his editor, longtime editor, his name is Michael Peach, was describing writing something very unwieldy, very difficult, that he couldn't map out quite right in his head as far as how to write it. But he felt like it was incredibly important that he do so, and that it would have been sort of the natural continuation to the stuff that he wrote in the 90s with Infinite Jest and a lot of his nonfiction essays, and eventually into kind of the more, for lack of a better term, mature stories of Oblivion and some of the stuff in his later career, where you can kind of see a writer moving out of their youth and moving into middle age and kind of writing about the effects of that. In one of those letters to Michael Peach, he actually lays out this concept that the only way he could really see getting this book done was that if he wrote out everything in his head, which would probably come to about 5,000 pages, and then send it all to him and then have him take an axe to it. Was what he described as probably being needed in order for this to just, like, get out of his head. But, of course, Michael Peach told him that he couldn't do that, that was far too tall of an order for one editor, much less a team of editors, to go through and still keep it coherent to his vision. And so he kind of had to go back to the drawing board. When David Foster Wallace did die, famously, you know, he moved his dogs out of the room that he hung himself in. And in his office, which was the garage of the home that he had with his wife, he had a stack of printed manuscript pages on his desk. And he used to write in rooms where he painted the walls completely black, and he covered the windows with black paint or blackout curtains. And then he surrounded himself with a bunch of lamps that he removed the shades off of. This was like the environment that he always wrote in. And he had one lamp in particular that he pointed down at the manuscript pages in his office. So it was very deliberate that he wanted them to do something with it. There was a note left, which has obviously never been published, never should be published, that evidently has some degree of instruction for Karen, his wife, to give to his editor. And thus began Michael Peach's sort of arduous process of trying to figure out how to assemble what did exist into a publishable form, which he eventually did, and the book was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Similar to what happened with Gravity's Rainbow, there was no award given the year this came out. So really, kind of symbolically, this book is what won the Pulitzer Prize that year, but for obvious reasons, the committee isn't going to award that to a posthumous unfinished novel as much as they probably wanted to. And from there, similar to Infinite Jest, it's difficult to sum up what the book is from a perspective of kind of the storyline, and is much easier to kind of give two narrative interpretations, one being the story itself, and then one being kind of what Wallace is trying to get at with his writing. What the book itself follows as far as a storyline goes is the Regional Examination Office for the Internal Revenue Service in Peoria, Illinois, and the associated wigglers or IRS examiners who work there and their lives in and out of the building. And that the book is pointing towards sort of this conspiracy that is never fully given the opportunity to be laid out, that somebody at the IRS is rigging the workplace to make it an absolute machine in which they can raise and lower the proficiency of the work coming out of it at will. And it wrapped up in that is the title character of the Pale King and what that has a reference to. But what the book is really more about is the concept of work in your adult life. And is probably best examined in light of what Infinite Jest is about, which is largely, happiness, long-term happiness versus short-term gratification, the things you give up to go after long-term happiness, the dangers of addiction, as analyzed through the 12-step program and also through, you know, halfway houses and alcohol or drug addiction, and then the achievements of, you know, high-level sort of athletic accomplishment and comparing and contrasting those, and then obviously like entertainment and technology and that. But it was very—it's very much sort of a book about the beginning of your adult life in a lot of ways. This idea that you kind of can go down two paths. One is this process that may be harder, that might be more arduous, but that eventually leads to long-term gratification. And the other is one that kind of, you know, it slowly cuts off your abilities to go after that long-term gratification through a series of instant gratifications that shove down all of the feelings that you really have. So if Infinite Jest is kind of the book about adolescence or early adulthood, then The Pale King is really the book about adulthood to middle age, and this concept that at a certain point, everyone will have to choose a job. There will be something you do day in and day out that you will probably do for the rest of your life, and then you'll retire. And that concept in American life of this idea that you are going to spend over the course of your existence on the planet more time at work than you will at home, and how it is that you can give yourself over to that process, not in a, like, you know, capitalist brainwashing way of like you're actually doing something important and you should give up all the time with your family because it's a good thing to give all your money to the corporation, but rather in a way of how can you live in this existing framework and also still find a degree of freedom for yourself is really what he's getting at there. And he is analyzing that through different lenses of how these characters operate. There are some characters that do have all of their kind of cards, so to speak, laid down on a bet on their work life, and that's what's going to provide them that long-term gratification that he kind of talks about in Infinite Jest. And he doesn't denigrate those people if that's truly what they need in life. There's a really great conversation midway through the book that is just too long to kind of try and find like a good piece of for like an instant quotable between a character who's known as a utility examiner, which are these kind of like low-level, low-paid IRS wigglers who are so valuable that they're never given a leg up, because to promote them is to lose the workability of that associate. And so they're moved around a lot. And then the other half of that conversation is this sort of older woman who's a bit of a higher pay grade than the utility examiner, telling him a story about how she met her husband, who's sort of actively dying. And we get a sense through that conversation that this person, that these two people are learning from each other. And that the idea of, like, if you're going to be a part of a working office, if you're going to be a part of a career, a job, yeah, it may suck, but in some cases you will be connected with people that you would never otherwise meet. And your ability to have genuine connections with those people through, you know, in this case, this big long conversation where they kind of learn from each other and learn about two different perspectives on viewing adult life and how they got to the places they are, is actually good for you in the long run. And that is a positive out of giving yourself over to this kind of like discipline of adult working life. So that's one example of how he uses those characters. You know, there are some characters who look at their opportunity in work as kind of like a redemption for their failures at home. There's one character who is in a situation where he has gotten a woman that he was dating pregnant, and because of the fact that they both have these religious tensions in their life, they feel uncomfortable about potentially terminating the pregnancy and getting an abortion. And so he applies himself at work so that he can hopefully be a better dad by providing for the child. And there's in a number of different examples that I can give as far as what goes on in this book, right? But again, some of it is hard to decipher because of the missing sort of texture or tissue. What really sits at the center of this book is essentially a novella that Wallace wrote and had actually considered publishing completely exterior to The Pale King, just on its own. And if you don't want to read The Pale King, I get it. If you feel uncomfortable about it being published as a posthumous novel, if you have issues with it not being finished, if it's going to drive you nuts that you don't know where it goes, I understand. McNally Editions, which is a small press imprint of Rand McNally, which is obviously a larger publisher, has been putting out sort of forgotten or lost material that the editor of that imprint just really likes, and they do these critical editions with introductions to them. There is a critical edition of that novella that was published. I think it was the third one they did. And that is called Something to Do About Paying Attention. And this novella that you can read either in The Pale King or in that separate edition follows sort of a self-described wastoid who kind of attends a particularly effective class on accounting. And it changes his life to give him some structure to exist in. And I've got some quotes from that I want to pull as kind of a illustration of the stuff that that Wallace is doing in this book. So this quote comes from page 228. At this point in the novella section of the novel, this main character, this wastoid, has ended up in a auditing or tax preparation class. I can't remember the specific name of the class, but midway through, they get a substitute, and the substitute is a long-time IRS guy who has been in the service for a long time, retired, and now teaches it and still takes it very, very seriously. One of the interesting things in this book is he kind of typifies the IRS as more of a military organization rather than a job that you would normally get. There is a recruiting station that the character in the novella goes to. And there's an arduous preparation process that he goes through to become a recruit of the IRS. And they're going to pay for his college. And then the IRS has these different intake days you would have in the military where you go in and get your head shaved and get your vaccines and get sorted into your bunks and stuff. The IRS does the same thing. David Foster Wallace makes a joke that anybody with a social security number starting with the number 9 is somebody who has at one point worked for the IRS. This idea that once you enter the agency, they kind of change your identity a bit. And whether you leave or stay, your social security number always identifies you as a former member of the IRS because your first number's a 9. And a lot of people have asked over the history of this book's existence, why the IRS? Why tax preparation? I think the idea that he was getting at there is by picking something that is so tedious and so boring to most people, the idea that all you would do all day, because he really sets it the entry-level jobs of this organization, is just process tax returns, is something work-wise that is so dull, so boring to the average person, that it can become a stand-in for the concept of work itself. That the idea that you would be doing something so tedious and so difficult and so unexciting to the average person can stand in as just this concept of how you may feel at a job, be it dead end or not. And that through that, and through its sort of typifying as a recruiting organization or a military organization or something that literally changes your identity, gets to the heart of work as an adult in the modern American landscape of it does change your identity. When you're on a date, the first thing people ask each other is, what do you do? When you meet people in public for the first time, that's also usually the first thing that they ask you. You come home and you talk to your spouse or your partner or your roommate or your friend about how your day was, and most of that is complaining about work. That these are aspects that you do end up being recruited into or giving yourself over to that change sort of your personhood in very fundamental ways. And the question is not, is that a good thing? No. He's very, very much so not on a weird capitalist bend with the book, but rather the idea of just if this is the world you live in, how can you make the best of that you possibly can? And so again, the absurdity of people taking tax preparation this seriously in the book works as I think an effective allegory for work itself. We're here on 228 at the end of the class. The substitute says, he said, "You will want something of a summation, then, an oration. It is not impossible that I misheard him," and what he actually said was exhortation. He looked quickly at his watch, making the same right-angled movement. "All right," he said. A small smile played around his mouth. He said, "All right." But it was clear that he wasn't joking or trying to slightly undercut what he was about to say, the way so many humanities professors of that era tended to mock themselves or their orations in order to avoid seeming uncool. It only struck me later, after I had entered the service as TAC, that this substitute was actually the first instructor I'd seen in any of the schools I drifted in and out of who seemed 100% indifferent about being liked or seen as cool or likable by the students, and realized, I did once I'd entered the service, what a powerful quality this sort of indifference could be in an authority figure. Actually, in hindsight, the substitute may have been the first genuine authority figure I ever met, meaning a figure with a genuine authority instead of just the power to judge you or squeeze your shoes from their side of the generation gap, and I became aware for the first time that authority was actually something real and authentic. That a real authority was not the same as a friend or someone who cared about you, but nevertheless could be good for you. And that the authority relation was not a democratic or equal one, and yet could have value for both sides, both people in the relation. I don't think I'm explaining this very well, but it's true that I did feel singled out. Spindled on those eyes in a way I neither liked nor didn't, but was certainly aware of. It was a kind of power that he exerted when I was granting him voluntarily. That respect was not the same as coercion, although it was a kind of power. It was all very strange. I also noticed that he now had his hands behind his back in something like the parade rest military position. He said to the accounting students, "All right then, before you leave here to resume that crude approximation of a human life you have heretofore called a life, I will undertake to inform you of certain truths. I will then offer an opinion as to how you might most profitably view and respond to these truths." I was immediately aware that he didn't seem to be talking about the advanced tax final exam. He said, "You will return to your homes and families for the holiday vacation, and in that festive interval before the last push of CPA examination study, trust me, you will hesitate. You will feel dread and doubt. This will be natural. You will, for what seems the first time, feel dread at your hometown chum's sallies about accountancy as a career before you. You will read the approval in your parents' smiles as an approval of your surrender. Oh, I have been there, gentlemen. I know every cobble in the road you are walking, for the hour approaches to begin in that literally dreadful interval of looking down before the leap outward to hear dolorous forecasts as to the sheer drudgery of the profession you are choosing. The lack of excitement or chance to shine on the athletic fields or ballroom floors to life heretofore. True, some of it I didn't quite get. I don't think too many of us in the classroom had spent a lot of time shining on ballroom floors, but that might have been just a generational thing. He obviously meant it as a metaphor. I certainly got what he meant about accounting not seeming like a very exciting profession." The substitute continued, "To experience commitment as the loss of options, a type of death, the death of childhood's limitless possibility, of the flattery of choice without duress. This will happen, mark me. Childhood's end, the first of many deaths. Hesitation is natural. Doubt is natural." He smiled slightly. "You might wish to recall, then, in 3 weeks' time, should you be so disposed, this room, this moment, and the information I shall now relay to you." He was obviously not a very modest or diffident person. On the other hand, his form of address didn't sound nearly as formal or fussy at this time in advanced taxes as it now sounds when I repeat it. Or rather, his summation was formal and a bit poetic, but not artificially so, like a natural extension of who or what he was. It was not a pose. I remember thinking that maybe the sub had mastered that trick in Uncle Sam posters and certain paintings of seeming to look right at you no matter what angle you faced him from. That perhaps all the hushed and solemn older other students, you could hear a pin, felt picked out and specifically addressed as well, though, of course, that would make no difference as to its special effect on me, which was the real issue, just as the Christian girlfriend story would have already demonstrated if I had been aware and attentive enough to hear what the actual point she was trying to make was. As mentioned, the version of me that listened to that story in 1973 or 74 was a nihilistic child. And it goes on there for several pages where it kind of goes back and forth between what the professor is saying and what the wastoid's thoughts on it are. But the idea of the speech as it's given is he calls them to account. And not just from a perspective of, you know, to fill out accounting forms and be an accountant and get a CPA and all that, but rather that as an adult giving yourself over to this kind of like thing that is drudgery or this death of your childhood innocence or whatever is also calling you to account for the life you live and the world that you live and how you relate to the people around you. That accounting in the parlance of this book allows you to do more than that and to have freedom within those limitations. And at the end of this long sort of novella, he decides to change his classes to accounting and CPA work, and that this speech is so stirring to him that, you know, he for the first time in his life was enjoying what he was working towards and was actually trying to accomplish something in college, and then goes through the recruitment process for the IRS, which is long and very funny in the kind of Wallacean bureaucratic humor that you will already know if you've read something like Infinite Jest. You know, he has to go to an office in the dead of winter, and it takes forever to get there, and when he does get there, the IRS agent's got sunglasses on because he thinks that something happened the night before, but the longer it goes on, it doesn't seem as though he's actually drunk, it's something else, and then the guy gives like an 8-hour long speech on the recruitment process itself, which is in and of itself a part of the recruitment process, and it's all this like set dressing to like weed people out. And then eventually, at the end of the first day in the recruitment office, he gives him this giant binder full of homework to read, and if he's still interested, he comes back the next day, and he figures out that that's all a test, that there's actually just two more forms he has to fill out tucked towards the back of the binder, and he comes back with those forms, and he gives them over, and it picks up here on 253 to the end of the novella. Anyhow, as I can still recall, the obvious idea was that anyone who was truly serious would make their best attempt to read the whole contents of the binder, would see and complete the relevant portions of the forms at the back, and then would make the effort to somehow commute back in, weather permitting, to the West Taylor recruiting station the next day by 9 a.m. for something which the final sheet termed advanced processing. It also snowed all night again, though not as heavily, and by 4 a.m. you could hear the terrible sound of the city of Libertyville's plows scraping the street's concrete raw outside my childhood room's window. Also, the bird sounds at sunrise were incredible, causing lights in some of the other houses along our street to come on in irritation. And the CTA was still only running a staggered schedule. Still, even given the rush of commuters at the time of day and the rigors of the trek in from Grant Park, I arrived at the storefront recruiting station no later than 9:20 a.m., albeit covered in snow again, to find no one else there from the day prior, except the same service recruiter, looking even more exhausted and disheveled, who, when I came in and said I was ready for advanced processing and gave him the forms from the homework I'd plowed through, looked from me to the forms and back again, giving me the exact kind of smile of someone who, on Christmas morning, has just unwrapped an expensive present he already owns. So, you know, and that isn't just, like, a great conclusion to the other themes in the novella that, again, there's just not time for us to go through it all, but also is the fact that David Foster Wallace is not unaware that there is a sense of ownership in these parts of working, that you are, in a way, owned by the people who pay you and who grant you, in this perspective, the difference of living your life dedicated to something versus not. Some of this is interesting because he takes it just beyond the characters that are in the novel. He brings it to himself as David Foster Wallace himself is a character in this book and relates his own time at the IRS. Which some people have said is true, that he did actually work there. Some people say that it is false. The only real truth that anyone has been able to figure out is that he did talk with a significant amount of tax preparers, and that anytime they brought up like a book to read on the history of the IRS or something that would help him like nail down the characters or the realism of the world, he had already read them. That's a story that someone does recall from that era where he was putting this book together. But again, to take it from just these fictional characters to the author, he also talks about his own aspect here. And it's very comical the way he introduces himself. On page 68, start of chapter 9, it says, "Author's foreword. Author here, meaning the real author, the living human holding the pencil, not some abstract narrative persona. Granted, there is sometimes such a persona in the Pale King, but that's mainly a pro forma statutory construct. An entity that exists just for legal and commercial purposes, rather like a corporation. It has no direct provable connection to me as a person, but this right here is me as a real person, David Wallace, age 40, Social Security number 97504-2012. Footnote 1. Little known fact. The only U.S. citizens anywhere whose Social Security numbers start with the numeral 9 are those who, or at were some time, contract employees of the Internal Revenue Service. Through its special relationship with the Social Security Administration, the IRS issues a new SS number on the day your contract starts. It's like you're born again, ID-wise, when you enter the service. Very few ordinary citizens know this. There's no reason they should, but consider your own Social Security number, or those of the people close enough to you that you're entrusted with their Social Security number. There's only one digit that those Social Security numbers never start with. That number is 9. Nine's reserved for the service, and if you're issued one, it stays with you for the rest of your life, even if you happen to have left the IRS long ago. It sort of marks you, numerically, every April, and quarterly, of course. For those who are self-employed and pay quarterly ESTs, those tax returns and ESTs whose file or social security numbers start with 9 are automatically pulled and routed through a special processing and exam program in the Martinsburg Computer Center. Your status in the system is forever altered. The service knows its own, always. Addressing you from my form 8829 Deductible Home Office at 725 Indian Hill Boulevard, Claremont, 91711, California, on this day, the 5th of spring, 2005, to inform you of the following. All of this is true. This book is really true. I obviously need to explain. First, please flip back page and look at the book's legal disclaimer, which is on the copyright page, verso side, or leaves in from the rather unfortunate and misleading front cover. The disclaimer is the unindented chunk that starts, the characters and events of this book are fictitious. I'm aware that ordinary citizens almost never read disclaimers like this, or the same way we don't bother to look at copyright claims or Library of Congress specs, or any of the dull pro forma boilerplate on sales contracts and ads that everyone knows is just there for legal reasons. But now I need you to read it, the disclaimer, and to understand that its initial, the characters and events in this book, includes this very author's foreword. In other words, this foreword is defined by the disclaimer as itself fictional, meaning that it lies within the area of special legal protection established by that disclaimer. I need this legal protection in order to inform you that what follows is, in reality, not fiction at all, but substantially true and accurate. The Pale King is, in point of fact, more like a memoir than any kind of made-up story. Which, again, none of that's true. Like, this is a very interesting thing that he's doing to play with the frame and the concepts that he's talking about, and how he shifts that to the reader. And it doesn't just stay with him. It actually does shift to the reader, as there's a chapter in here where he changes the indentation and the typesetting of the book to match a two-column legal form. And this is chapter 25, which, if you have a physical copy of the book, is also page 312, where it says, irrelevant, Chris Fogel turns a page. Howard Cardwell turns a page. Ken Wax turns a page. Matt Redgate turns a page. Groovy Bruce Channing attaches a form to a file. Ann Williams turns a page. Anand Singh turns two pages at once by mistake and turns one back, which makes a slightly different sound. David Cusk turns a page. Sandra Pounder turns a page. Robert Atkins turns two separate pages of two separate files at the same time. Ken Wax turns a page. Lane Dean Jr. turns a page. Olive Borden turns a page. And it goes on like this for four pages. And so, again, he's shifting the frame to include the reader itself being put through the work of reading something that is itself formatted like what these characters would be reading, which, again, can spin out into so many different, like, interesting, like, metafictional elements as that relates to the fact that David Foster Wallace, the writer, is completing his work as a writer by completing this book, but in and of itself was not finished, and neither his time as a writer was. Like, there's a lot of interesting elements that, when you look at it from that metafictional lens, or how he's trying to translate these ideas about work onto his reader, that it becomes a incredibly fascinating exercise that, when you get to that chapter 25, it has a lot more meaning than you would expect from something just being descriptions of people turning pages. Which is not to say that the book is not without its humor. David Foster Wallace remained a very funny writer, even as his depression and eventual suicidality took, you know, leaps and bounds forward. The section in which he recounts his own personal time going through intake at the IRS is incredibly funny. It is a very long chapter that, again, I wish I could get into, but to do so, this podcast would be probably an hour and a half long of just me reading. but it's this whole thing where he gets up too late because his alarm clock doesn't go off on time. And then he gets to the train station just a bit too late. And so he has to catch the next train. And when he gets to the next train station, despite the fact that he's late, the actual train he needs to be on has been delayed, so now he's on time, but also he's stuck with a bunch of other IRS examiners waiting for intake who are dressed significantly better than him and are wearing hats, so now he's self-conscious about himself, and it's way too hot outside, so he's starting to sweat, and he's really worried about that, And then eventually the train gets into where it's going, and then he has to get in a cab, and he's sweating too much, and the cab has no AC because it's broken, and so he's sweating even more, and he's pressed up against two other guys in the backseat of this cab that he's going to be working with, but he's going to be worried about whether or not they think that he's just that weird sweaty guy who came in with a car with them on their first day, and whether or not his sweat is going to ruin the suit. And then it turns out that there's so many people going in for intake that it's just a line of cabs down the street trying to get into the IRS building that's actually holding up traffic, because the building itself was renovated 20 years into its usage, and the entrance was flipped from the entrance to what was the back entrance. And so now the parking lot is technically in the back of the building, and the door was ripped out, so you have to walk all the way around the building through a retention pond that was man-made to beautify the grounds to get up to the front of the building. And just he keeps building all of this, like, these layers of absurdity onto it that are incredibly funny. And I do have a section here from that piece that I find really, really funny. Where it says, as to our actual physical arrival at the center's main entrance on that first day, all I can say by way of summary is that there is an indescribable thrill about seeing one's own printed name on a sign held up at a crowded place of disembarkation. I suppose part of it is that one feels especially picked out, and to use the bureaucratic term, validated. The special sign with my name on it held aloft by an attractive, official-looking woman in a bright blue blazer was also obviously, after all the ignominies and demeaning hassles and consequent lateness, surprising, though not so surprising that any person could be reasonably expected to have seen it as immediate evidence of some error or confusion. There was, after all, the aforementioned matter of nepotistic justice and letter in my dispatch case. This was also when it emerged that the REC's ostensible rear was really the front, and that the two orthogonal parts of the center were not continuous, and that the building's main facade was stylized in a strange and kind of intimidating way that one would concede it was maybe prudent to keep from facing or looming over the crowded public road just south. Even without the crowding and chaos, the whole huge main entrance area was complex and disorienting. There were flags, coded signs, directional arrows, and a kind of broad concrete plaza with what looked to have been a fountain but had no water spurting. Footnote 34. It turned out that the fountain was broken and an obscure hydraulic part was on. The main building's square shadow extended almost all the way across the plaza to the two highly desirable parking lots opposite, neither of which was all that large, and there was the REC's elaborate and obviously expensive facade, which extended just above the main entrance to the middle of what appeared to be the fifth floor. It was some kind of tile or mosaic representation of a blank IRS 1978 Form 1040, both pages of it, complete in all detail down to verso line 31 slot for the computation of adjusted gross income, and recto line 66 terminal balance due box, which box served, along with the form's myriad other slots and boxes and inset squares, is what looked to be windows. The detail was striking in the cream, salmon, and celadon of offset colors, realistic if slightly dated. Footnote 35. There had been certain changes and modifications to the 1040 since 1978, the details of which I would come to know all too well over the coming months. Also, to make the whole thing even more overwhelming and disorienting, wasn't seen all at once from the circular spur off the access road when service vehicles could pull right up and offload their passengers without having to park, which would have necessitated going all the way back out and around again since the parking lot's just the opposite the entrance across the plaza were completely full, and even had some extra vehicles parked in prohibited corner spaces that would keep other vehicles from being able to back out of their spaces and exit. The giant 1040, which was realistically proportioned to scale, and so was slightly longer than it was wide, was flanked at either distant end by a large, round, inset intaglio or glyph of some kind of chimerical combat and a Latin phrase, indecipherable in the right-hand side's deep shadow, which turned out to be the surface's official seal and motto, none of which I had been told in my contractual materials, which, as mentioned, tended to be both cryptic and tonally stern or urgent, really little more than families unused, really little more than engines of apprehension as far as I'd been concerned, sitting in my family's unused parlor and trying to parse them. By way of one more detail, the whole elaborate facade assembly was reflected, though in an angled and laterally foreshortened way that made the edges glyph and motto look closer together than they actually were, by the garishly mirrored exterior side of REC's other structure, aka the REC Annex, which lay at almost a perfect right angle to the main facade and was connected at two floors to the main building's west bridge by what appeared to be large green tubes supported by blinding, since not in the main building shadow, forests of slender anodized or stainless steel poles, which metal supports look strange and millipedic from this angle, and were further reflected in the blinding little angled slices by the edges of the annex mirrored exterior. So, like, the way that he depicts the IRS is this very interesting organization that is, like, weirdly artistic in a lot of its presentation, but also very serious in its recruiting and all of that. And it lends a lot of humor to the novel. Another one of such jokes comes from page 348. It's the whole of chapter 28, which is the 10 laws of IRS personnel. All GS-9 examiners want to be GS-11 examiners. All GS-11 examiners want to be auditors. All collections want to be the CID. All auditors want to be appeals managers or supervisors. All group managers. All CIDs want to be almost anything that doesn't involve site surveillance. Some appeals officers want to be group managers. All group managers want to be deputy district directors, or else they dream of being examiners again, alone at a desk with no one to bother you. All deputy district directors want to be district directors. It's the ones who tell you they don't want to that you need to watch out for. Some district directors want to be DRECs or DRSCs or regional commissioners, but all these are political appointments, and the best the district director can do is make their district's output look really good and hope someone notices. Output is the ratio of collected tax to district expenses. It's the district's net profit. The service code is very simple, as the DDDs say, as they circle the DD, plotting output or kaput, supply or die, revenue or a revue. A revue almost always means backwater postings. Which of those is each law? I don't know. There's more than 10 things listed. But again, through a joke, he not only adds texture to the world that he's building, but also really does lay out what a series of promotions at your job is like. You know, you take on a bit more responsibility, then you get to a point where you don't want to be that anymore, and you'd rather just be the starting guy again. And then if you go any higher, it becomes political, and there's all sorts of other things added to it that aren't really the actual context of your work. So again, even in the humor, he's making a lot of very clever sort of remarks or you know, analyzing different aspects of working culture. And then I'm going to end with a quote here on page 29. That is the whole of chapter 4 that I just, again, I think is both really funny, but then also does some of the critique and also some of the other stuff that he's getting to with this book, which is from the Peoria Journal Star, Monday, November 17th, 1980, page C2. IRS worker dead for 4 days. Supervisors at the IRS's regional complex in Lake James Township are trying to determine why no one noticed that one of their employees had been sitting dead at his desk for 4 days before anyone asked if he was feeling all right. Frederick Blomquist, 53, who had been employed as a tax return examiner with the agency for over 30 years, suffered a heart attack in the open plan office he shared with 25 coworkers at the agency's regional examination center on Self Storage Parkway. He quietly passed away last Tuesday at his desk, but nobody noticed until late Saturday evening when an office cleaner asked how the examiner could still be working in an office with all the lights off. Mr. Blomquist's supervisor, Scott Thomas, said Frederick was always the first guy in each morning, and the last to leave at night. He was very focused and diligent, so no one found it unusual that he was in the same position all the time and didn't say anything. He was always absorbed in his work and kept to himself. A post-mortem examination by the Tazewell County Coroner's Office yesterday revealed that Blomquist had been dead for 4 days after suffering from a coronary. Ironically, according to Thomas, Blomquist was part of a special task force of IRS agents examining the tax affairs of medical partnerships in the area where he died. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons to enjoy the actual reading process of the book in my mind. And even if you never fully get an idea of the conspiracy that's going on or what the ultimate points that Dave Foster Wallace is working towards, I think that it is a book that becomes a lot more deeply relatable the older you get and the more into like a set career you are. That is the kind of world that he's trying to depict there, and how if you're going to choose anything as far as a discipline, allow it to give you at least the freedom of movement at other areas of your life, as you kind of slave away at the corporate machine, so to speak. I think it's a really beautiful book that I'm glad was published and that I think has a lot to be gleaned from it. I wish that I could read the 5,000-page version, because the world that he creates, much like the world he creates in Infinite Jest, I just find so compelling. But, you know, it's one that I think has unfortunately not gotten its due from a lot of people who have read his work in the more recent history, simply because of the fact that it's unfinished, or because they have, you know, certain qualms about the fact that it was published in the first place. So, yeah, read The Pale King. If you don't want to read the whole thing, which I totally get, all of the ideas that he's getting at are very easily compressed in that novella version. which again is called Something to Do About Paying Attention. I would highly recommend everyone pick up this book.
It sounds like, I mean, a lot of that hits close to home, if I'm being honest.
Sure, yeah.
You know, I work in corporate America. I hate every minute of it, but it's a job and it provides for my family. And it does, at the end of the day, like, it does afford me the time and opportunity to pursue the things that I do want to do. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, there is a lot of conflict within me that you know, I have to deal with. And I think, so to give a little bit of backstory on myself and my relationship with Wallace, I started on Infinite Jest earlier this year, and I was enjoying it. I had to bounce off of it though because it got a little too real in the description of one of the characters and their battle with depression. As someone who deals with that myself, it could be hard to read those kind of things sometimes, and at the time that was not a good time for me to read that, so I had to kind of put it away, and I do plan on revisiting it, but at the time it was just a little bit too much. So this has been the other one I've been looking at. Do you think that, and I guess this is kind of what I was going to ask initially when you mentioned that you were going to do this book. I think a lot of people come to David Foster Wallace and the entry point, much as with Penchon, everyone kind of thinks that you have to jump on with Gravity's Rainbow. I think everyone kind of thinks with Wallace, you have to jump on with Infinite Jest. Do you think that The Pale King might be a better entry point for those unfamiliar with his work to kind of get a taste of what he has to offer as an author?
Better than Infinite Jest, yes. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's probably the best place to start with his work. I think that depending upon A, your level of investment, and B, you know, what your kind of interest in things are, I think you can go as easy as just starting with his graduating commencement speech to the class at Kenyon in 2005. That was published as This Is Water, like a separate volume. Mm. Or you can listen to it. That's 20 minutes of your time. I think that if you want to get into kind of his broader sort of like critiques of modern American life or of kind of the absurdity of modern life in a lot of ways, then A Supposedly Fun Thing Again, I'll Never Do Again is a perfect place to start. If you specifically want his fiction, I think that Oblivion is probably the best place to start, that collection of short stories. But if you're going to go for one of the three novels, I would probably say that, yeah, The Pale King is probably the best place to start. But I think also some of that is dependent on where you're at in life. You know, I think that if a teenager read The Pale King, no, that's going to be, it's going to be like a terrible time for them.
Yeah.
But if you're someone who works in corporate America or works in management or works in any kind of job that is sort of considered to be a career, or even to a certain extent, if you've had just the same kind of like, not typified career job of like fast food or service industry for a long time, then yeah, you'll probably get a lot out of it. I think that it's one that is best experienced later in life or revisited later in life. But from a perspective of its density, of its length, and all of that, I would say it's the best novel to go for as far as the easiest to get into.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I've read pretty much everything by David Foster Wallace, and everything in book form, basically. And I agree with Kate. I think if you're going to start with fiction, I would start with Oblivion. I was actually going to say that even if you didn't say it, Kate. Which, of his short fiction, I think that's probably his most successful and his best. Although for you, Cody, it does feature some pretty harrowing descriptions of depression.
And suicide.
Yeah, which can be pretty haunting. But yeah, so my question is, I mean, I've read The Pale King. I read it maybe 8 or 9 years ago, so it's been a while, but it did strike me more as a story cycle than a novel, as it's published, at least, because I do want your opinion on that, Kate, but to justify it, there are some parts of the novel that I didn't necessarily understand how they're related to other parts. You know, like the part where the young couple is talking about abortion and stuff, you know, that doesn't seem super related to the stuff about the IRS. I don't remember. You might could correct me. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember it really having any much to do with the IRS. And there's a good chunk of the novel that is just kind of stories kind of set in the university created. So yeah, I was just wondering what you thought about that.
Yeah, I think obviously some of it is the fact that it's unfinished, right? That we'll never know for sure. But there is, so I actually ran a reading group for this book on the David Foster Wallace subreddit, which I'm a moderator for. So if there's anybody on this podcast that is part of that subreddit, hi, I'm Katie Hawk. I'm the person who ran all those group reads we did a few years ago. And this was a point of conversation for us as well. That conversation back and forth about the abortion, the man in that couple, Lane Dean Jr., is one of the IRS examiners who shows up at later points in the book. And it seems clear that his sort of storyline, so to speak, would have been that he joined the IRS or stayed at the IRS in order to kind of deepen the relationship with the woman that he ended up having to marry. And then also his child. In fact, if I remember correctly, there's a part in the book where you are in Lane's head as he's counting down the minutes before he can leave and go home. And part of what's like sustaining him at his desk is a photo of his child, which kind of answers the question as to what the couple decided to do and like what he's doing there at the IRS. You know, and part of what we had talked about in the group reads was the idea of like the boy who wanted to like touch every bit of his body with his tongue, or the like savant character who is like running political elections in middle school, are also probably other IRS examiners. I think that the like child savant or whatever ends up being one half of the conversational partners in that long dialogue scene between the two of them in the bar. And you know, you kind of see how that kid ended up as like a utility examiner. And then or is potentially the kid who wanted to touch every part of his body with his tongue. I think what eventually David Foster Wallace was going to kind of do was look at the death of childhood as it's spoken about in the long sort of exhortation by the substitute professor, through the lens of showing you the different points of life of all of the different agents that were in his cast of characters from the Peoria IRS Center, and how elements of childhood do still carry forward into your adult life, but that they change somewhat to fit the mold of your life as an adult now. And that while, yes, you are no longer a child, and while, yes, there is a death of childhood, so to speak, that those characteristics never leave you, and instead they find another sort of toehold or purchase in your adult life with your adult responsibilities, seems to be what he is going for. And then the secondary plot, or like the antagonist of the story, is how that cast of characters is manipulated by their bosses. I don't know, and that as an outgrowth of sort of a critique about labor or work and the modern world as a whole. The idea that you have all of these like richly textured people that you work with, right? You don't know them very well, but if you talked to them like the two characters do for 70 pages, then you would actually experience something great out of that potentially. And that these buildings full of people that have rich textural lives about how they've ended up there end up being manipulated by the Pale King or the system, I think is really what he's kind of getting at there with the IRS, and how these bosses are able to at will raise or lower the productivity. I think that it would also work as a story cycle, but I have a feeling based upon reading Michael Peach's foreword and some of the other like history with it and how David Foster Wallace talked about it in his letters before publishing it, that it seemed like he was really going for a novel.
Yeah, I got you. I forgot some of that. So yeah, that does help. Have you read Lunar Park by Bret Easton Ellis?
I have not. I haven't read any Bret Easton Ellis.
So Lunar Park, it came out in the early 2000s, and it does kind of do the same thing that the David Wallace / David Foster Wallace, like the intro thing that you read, where he plays with his, you know, like the role of the author and versus, you know, the person and stuff. Lunar Park, it's like, it features Bret Easton Ellis as like a college professor, and the intro to it is like a grandized version of his real life and stuff. I was just wondering, because it does play with some of that same stuff that Borges kind of plays with in that piece from the Epigraph.
Yeah, that's cool. I'll have to check that out. I have not read it. Well, that, I think, brings us to the end of this bonus episode. I've made offhand mentions to David Foster Wallace a lot over the recording of the past few seasons of the show. And this is just an example of kind of a piece of his bibliography that I really enjoy and why I really enjoy it. I hope some of our listeners want to go and read the book now. I understand why it's got some of its difficulties from its relatableness for a lot of people. But I do think it is highly worth the time. And you are rewarded with some very good moments of humor in the book for sticking through it. Thanks everybody for listening. We will see you guys next week with another one of our bonus episodes. That's all I got. Bye.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye.